Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You have found the Shanny Pants Show. Hello, it's Shanny, the least influential influencer that there ever was. With a heart full of laughter and a journey that runs deeper than the trendiest makeup You may know me from my ridiculously comedic fashion and makeup tutorials on social media, but guess what? There's so much more to the story. I was born, raised, and married in a cult. When I left the cult at 31 years old, I had no knowledge about real life or how to process what I had been through. I felt very alone. The past couple of years, I've been on an incredible journey of learning, growing, and recovery, and I'm excited to share this with you. I'll bring you stories from the Cultiverse, where many cult survivors and experts share their knowledge and experiences. Their stories are more than inspiring. They're a roadmap to self-discovery and resilience. So get ready for a podcast that's part comedy, part wisdom, and a whole lot of heart. If you feel alone in your journey, my hope is that that will change once you hear these stories. Welcome to the Shanny Pants Show.
I am the founder of Tears of Eden. I run Tears of Eden. It is a community and resource for survivors of spiritual abuse from the evangelical community. So we have a podcast, which is Uncertain, which is what you were on. And we do resources, written resources, Instagram resources. That's our main social media places, at Uncertain Podcast on Instagram. And then we also do support groups. We're working on that part of it. We really want those to be free to survivors. So we have to raise the money for those support groups. So we don't know if they're going to happen this year because we're working on raising the funds for them. But it's very important to us that they are free to people because when folks leave cults, but then when folks end up having to leave churches or church jobs, you spend so much money on therapy and meds, and a lot of people have had to lose their careers and lose their jobs, and so we just didn't want to add that extra financial burden. And so that's very important to us. We'll see if it's going to work. We have been piloting these programs for about 2 years. They're really great. They're really, really, really awesome. We have mental health professionals that run them. I'm also a mental health professional. I work with cult survivors and folks who have experienced sexual abuse, spiritual abuse survivors, religious trauma. And I am also a published author of a novel. My first novel came out in 2021. It seems as if it doesn't have anything to do with anything else that I do. Yet, I'm very passionate about art and how art helps us heal and plays a role in our healing process and helps us just survive. So very passionate about that. That's me.
I love everything that you do. And now that I have met you in person, I just love you even more. And I think that the need is so great for what you do, because obviously we see it out there all the time. And I love that you are, I'll drop a link too in the notes, because I love that you are trying to raise money for survivors. what I love about what you're doing now and other people that are doing similar things is that there are even these resources out there now. You know, like I think about, it's been like 12 years since I've gotten out. There was nothing. Like I wouldn't have even known what to look up. Where now with social media and podcast, I feel like if people just search, you know, spiritual recovery or spiritual abuse or religious abuse, whatever they word it, you're going to find something. And like you had mentioned, even just the Instagram, like I follow a lot of Instagrams on mental health and healing and just seeing like little snippets on Instagram is value, you know? And so I love how many people like you are doing this because I do feel like the need is so great.
And it's very new. Like it's, I was interviewing someone yesterday and we were looking up some books that we had both found that were helpful to us. And we were like looking up when they came out, and they came out in like the last 10 years. Like this is not something that's been around for hundreds of years. It's very, very new. Like within the past decade, a lot of the stuff we know. So we're at the frontier of this type of recovery and understanding dynamics of course of control and power and all of these things that we're just kind of starting to unpack of the amount of damage that it does.
Well, and I feel like too with mental health being more in like the forefront of, you know, our country right now, and you know, supposedly. It's supposed to be like, you know, all these changes, and I'm still like with insurance and stuff. I'm like, no, like mental health.
Yeah. And then what mental health professionals make versus what other industries make. And just, it's just ridiculous. Like it, our money is not saying that we value it. And a lot of the good therapists, especially like the trauma therapists and stuff, don't accept insurance simply because insurance doesn't pay them enough. And so they're just like, you know, and a lot of them, everyone that I know, including myself, we have slots for folks who can't pay that much. Most people do that. Most people have sliding scale, but insurance just doesn't pay well. So a lot of them are leaving insurance and just like, I'm not taking insurance anymore because they don't make enough money for what they do and how much training they have to have and how much continuing ed credits we have to have and all of the things that we are investing every year to maintain our credentials on top of working with people. So yeah, it's kind of like art and then mental health field and then other things.
Yes.
And I would go fields that are undervalued in the society. And then if you're looking for someone with like the dynamic of understanding religious trauma or understanding cult trauma, like it's going to be really hard to find something that works. So,
and when you find them, they're very booked up and very expensive. And it just, it is what it is. But it is hard.
On that note, though, I do have openings for more clients, should anyone be listening. So
yes, let's talk about kind of your story. What brought you to decide to do this? Because I don't really know. Like, I know you and we've chatted, but I don't really know your real story. Like, what kind of prompted you, or was there anything, or did you just always want to do this?
Yeah, I just woke up one day. And
did you? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Survivors of spiritual abuse. No, there's a story.
That seems like something that just falls into your head. Yeah.
Yes. And I feel like a lot of folks who end up doing this work also have a personal experience. There are some unicorns that didn't have a personal experience and for personal reasons became interested in it. But I feel like most folks have a personal experience, and I do have personal experience. I grew up in what I will call a fundamentalist cult, which was very similar to the group that you grew up in. Like, and even just things like women weren't allowed to go to college and very, very cloistered. And like, these are the friends you're allowed to have because they think like us and like-minded believers, and everything was based on the Bible. And so grew up very similar to the way that you described that you grew up as well. Homeschooled, and about 16 is when we got into this thinking. For folks who want to Google it, the Christian patriarchy movement or the stay-at-home daughter movement. And some of the leaders are Doug Phillips, Doug Wilson, Bill Gothard, Shiny Happy People. Those are some of the more well-known folks associated with this movement. And so that's how I grew up. And when I left, it's probably what I left when I was like 26. And the way that I left and the way that I like plotted my escape and spent like 2 years coming up with a plan and, you know, secretly taking my parents off my bank account, doing college in secret. A lot of the things that I did are very similar to like a domestic violence situation where like a wife in a domestic violence situation is planning and putting things in place and saving money and secretly having to do all these things in order to escape. That's probably what was most similar to my escape. And left, had a college degree when I left finally, and had very little work experience, very little resume experience. And so I knew like the main thing that I needed to survive was money. And so just that reality of how limited they keep you as a form of control so that you can't leave because you don't have the resources to. Yeah. And I'm unpacking more of that now of like, oh, this was like an intentional withholding of resources so that you couldn't leave. They would never say that, but they would say it was God's will and living a biblical life. So I left that, fell into ministry, was my chosen career choice. And the church played a huge role in my escape and my recovery. And I had what I would describe at the time, a good experience with the church, and decided that I wanted to go into ministry full time, went on the mission field, went to seminary. And I saw little signs of it, but it took a chronic situation of spiritual abuse at a church I worked for in California about 4 years ago now that allowed me and prompted me to wake up and realize that the same things that I experienced in this fundamentalist cult were very much present in evangelicalism. They're just way more subtle. And all of things like, you know, women, you are equal to men. You just have a different role. And just these phraseologies of things and the way that things are presented and who is trusted and who is not. And this very patriarchal, just a very patriarchal system that did not benefit women or minorities and didn't really care for children either. Like, I was in youth ministry and I saw just the way that, you know, the youth were always like sidelined and the youth ministry always had the fewest resources, you know, just stuff like that were very similar to the cult that I grew up in. They were just presented in a much nicer, kosher, more politically correct way. It took me almost a decade to see it, and I believed what they told me. and so there's definitely been some like, oh, so I left, you know, one form of fundamentalism into a different form of fundamentalism, and I just thought it was so much better, but it really wasn't much better. And realizing now and giving myself compassion now for the fact that like I did think it was better, and I did think that I was doing something different, and I did believe the things that people told me, which were lies that they believed when they told them to me, and that it made sense. And if I had gone from fundamentalism into like the super progressive world, patriarchy exists everywhere. So, and it's just because it says it's progressive doesn't mean that it actually is. And I actually found that out before I decided to leave ministry, of just like, it's going to be this way everywhere. I'm done with this. So while I was at the church is where I came up with the idea for Tears of Eden, because when I left the fundamentalist cult, I left alone. I was completely alone. I had no resources. I had no language for naming what happened to me. It was years before I was even using the word abuse to describe what I had went through. And so I had nothing. I had people who were like supportive of me. They were like, this isn't good and we want you to have a better life. But no one was like, this is abusive and like, this is wrong. And so I left it very isolated, very alone. When I was going through the situation at the church, though, a lot of people were going through it at the same time on staff. And so there was like kind of some community happening around it. And we would meet at each other's houses at midnight after the kids had gone to bed and eat popcorn and drink whiskey. And so we had some community around what was happening. And then other books were coming out and podcasts were coming out. So we were like sharing them with each other and we had language to name this experience. And so I wanted to create that type of experience for people leaving, because when you leave, you typically leave so isolated. That is still 100% true. Most people leave alone or with just their family. Very few people leave in community. And so that was the idea for Tears of Eden, was providing resources and language to name the experience, and then providing connection to people who have gone through the same thing. So that is the long story of how Tears of Eden came about.
And I do think there is like so much value in your story being, not that people can't do what you do without a backstory, but I do think that having an experience with something for let's say a client coming in, it means more, you know, because it's like, okay, she truly gets it. Like you remember what it was like. And I even think that now, just talking to people on the podcast or whatever, I've been out for 12 years now, and yet I can still remember what it was like to be in there, like the feelings of guilt, the feelings of like putting shame on people, because it's what we were told, you know, it's what we did. And so there's something about that, having lived through an experience like that, me explaining it to you, you're gonna get it. You're gonna be like, okay, I remember, like I was just there not too long ago. So that is, I think there's definitely value in that. Again, not to say someone else can't be an awesome, you know, trauma therapist without that, but I do see as a client coming in, like, hey, have you ever experienced any yourself? And yes, you have. So
yeah, and I feel like for trauma in general, I know a lot of therapists, this is changing in the mental health world, but a lot of therapists are trained to kind of be unemotional when they're interacting. And that can actually be re-traumatizing for a trauma survivor whose emotions are just and to like come in and like run up against a steel wall. And so like trauma recovery coaches, like we're trained to like engage emotionally with people and like or what you're feeling actually makes a lot of sense. And actually, when you told me that, I got really angry hearing that they did that to you, and just allowing that emotional engagement and creating a space where emotions are okay. And I feel like that can have it, and bringing our own stories into the space as well. It's still about the client, but there is a way to disclose tactfully that lets them know they're not alone, because as trauma survivors, we just feel crazy. Like, when we've experienced abuse, it's like, was this my fault? Why did this happen? Why did they do this to me? What about me? Made them target me? That, all of those internal messages that we have in our heads that are placed there by abusers.
I love that you're saying that's changing in therapy, because I had never really thought of that, but it's true. Like when I think about my original therapist, very, like you said, no emotion. Love her to death, but like picturing her versus who I'm using now, that is very interesting.
Yeah, and even just like I have a trauma therapist now too, and my previous therapist, for sure, same thing. Great, love them, super helpful, but the trauma therapist is just very different and very, and just engaged and like oh, I can tell she doesn't like my parents.
Yes.
I can tell she is not a fan. And she is yes. letting me see that she is not a
You're
fan.
You're like, you got it. You picked up on that, huh?
Yes.
Oh, that is so great. Oh, yes. My gosh. Now, is most of what you do right now with your clients, is it all virtual?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's one of the reasons why I went the route that I went, is because I didn't want to be tied to a state. And a lot of therapists are doing that. They're adding on that, like, coaching credentials so that they can see people across state lines. And then they're saying, like, when I meet with you, I'm a coach, not a therapist, and, you know, that kind of thing, because there are state line issues with being a therapist. So,
okay. So when you mentioned you kind of just threw your parents in there. So now I have a question about that too. So your family, you said you joined at 16. Mm-hmm. What was your family doing up till 16, and how was that? And then dragging you into something like that at 16. Like, I just picture myself at 16. I was already in, but I was already like, mm-hmm. I want out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think I'm actually grateful that it didn't happen until I was 16, because I would say that my father, in my opinion, was abusive up until then. But it wasn't the same type of control until we encountered the Christian patriarchy movement, and it was almost like he was just like looking for and like waiting for the thing that would allow him to take full control of his family and turn his family into his homegrown incubator for his personal gratification, which is basically what it became. And so at 16, I remember when he announced this wonderful vision for our family, that we're going to be just this wonderful experience, and none of the girls were going to go to college, and we were going to prepare, stay home and prepare to be wives and mothers. In this meeting, I remember it very vividly, our family meeting, just breaking down in tears. And it was, I didn't realize until that moment that I was like looking forward to leaving and going away to college, and didn't make the connections of like the abuse and the control that was already happening, that this was like my escape. I didn't make that connection. I didn't know that that's what was happening. But I realized how much I was looking forward to that. And now it's getting ripped from me. And I'm like, I am stuck in this family and stuck in this house. I cannot leave. And it was just kind of that throughout the next 10 years of like, I'm stuck. And I look back.
And you lived at home.
Mm-hmm.
Till 26.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I just remember, like, I look back on that time, I was like, I was so depressed. I didn't know I was depressed, but like, I was high functioning depression. I had tons of anxiety. I left. I don't know if you experienced this when you left, but very common to experience the phobias of like, God is going to strike me down, strike me with lightning. Some catastrophe is right around the corner because I did this, like that, just like panic of like, I'm going to die because I left. I experienced that right after I left, just the first night and almost went back. And the only reason why I didn't is because I had spent 2 years plotting my escape. And the logic in my brain was like, it has to stop. I have to end now. But yeah, we were very weird in our community. People didn't understand why we weren't going to college. My father wanted me to answer, I'm preparing to be a wife and mother, so I don't need to go to college. I couldn't do it. It was mortifying. I could not do it. And I tried to kind of come up with things that I did, but really I wasn't doing anything. I was like managing my parents' budget and cooking food for my family and going grocery shopping. I didn't really get to do anything that was fulfilling and enjoyable. And I liked school. I still like school. I really enjoy it. And so my last 2 years of high school were a total joke and I hated it. Like, I was just like, and then when I went to college and I was doing college in secret, like, I liked it. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the challenge. And then later went to grad school. I like studying. I like learning. I like seeing A's at the top of my paper and taking exams. And I'm like, I enjoy it. And so it was just like so sad to me that it was like whipped away. And it's like, it doesn't matter that you enjoy it. Your job is to get married and have babies. Like, there's no consideration for dreams, desires. You're not really supposed to have them unless they are completely aligned with your father and or your husband. And my sisters had an easier time, at least the two that were right under me. And they said, they will say this, they were like, we had an easier time because the things that we liked doing happened to be things that our father valued. Like, I had a sister who became a floral designer. He thought that he appreciated that. I had another sister who became a personal trainer. He valued that, like, that those were things that he valued. So they had an easier time, whereas I liked theater. Wow. And
right.
Reading and school and all of these things that just, like, he just didn't
pass.
Get. Yeah. He didn't get. So I wasn't super athletic. I wasn't the golden child. We'll just say that.
Wow. How sad for you.
I know. But I get to do what I want now.
Yes. Making up for all
the world
those
is
years.
My oyster. I can do
yes, it
whatever
is.
I want. Endless possibilities.
Okay. So you left at 26, and did you go straight to college from there then? How were you taking classes privately? Was it online that you were able
yes,
to get some?
I did. Classes online, and I don't know anyone else who's done it this way. So if you're out there and you have done college this way, email me. I'd love to hear. But you can take CLEP tests, which are like testing out of like full subjects. And so for about a year, I took one CLEP test a week, and I tested out of like 2.5 years of college, and so like almost did 3 years of college in a year, and then I did the rest of it, which is online classes, and just found a college that would like accept all the CLEP credits and then also had a degree. And at that point I was just, I need a college degree. I'm trying to apply for jobs and they say bachelor's degree required. So I just need a bachelor's. They don't care what it is. They just want a bachelor's, which I will say, after my experience, is very elitist. And I know that that is just a very normal thing to request from people, but it's elitist. It is very expensive to go to college, especially right now. And there are wonderful people who can do amazing things who do not have college degrees. And that is separating the haves from the have-nots. And I would never put that as a requirement on a job description. Momentary soapbox, but so it was just like, get it done. I was nannying. There's a whole story of my father kicking me out of the house and me being gone for 8 weeks and then going back. And once I went back, I think my father was like intent on like keeping me happy because he realized how close he was to like losing me. And so we had this very odd relationship where we like pretended everything was fine. And during that time, I was doing it all in secret, not telling him that it was happening, because I'm like, if he finds out that I'm plotting to leave, he will sabotage. And so I did all of these things without telling him. I was working as a nanny for a night nurse. And so I worked from like 3 to 11. And so after the kids went to sleep, I studied, and that was how I did it. And so I finished 18 months, a 4-year degree in 18 months.
And did you just like save every penny you made? And basically that went towards your college? Mm-hmm. Wow. And then as far as like plotting to leave, what was the plot? I wasn't basically saving up enough to where you could leave. Was that kind of the main thing? And like you had said, taking them off your bank account.
Yeah. So I think the main things that I needed, like I wasn't going to be able to pay for college and do school at the same time. And it was like the goal was like get that college degree. So I was living with my parents while I was doing it. So I didn't have the burden of also paying. Actually, I was paying my parents' rent, but not as much rent as I pay my parents' rent, but had zero agency over my life. Let's just talk about that for a minute. But not as much as if I were like living on my own or had roommates or something. I probably could have made it happen. But it really was like every single penny was going towards school. And then when I got kicked out of my house, my parents kicked me out for taking a job, a part-time job, without asking my father's permission. And then he kicked me out. And then at the time, I didn't own a car. My father owned our cars. And so that was like, and I was working for a church and the church like lent me a car. So that was like my first experience like with the church actually helping and supporting someone who really needed it. And so they lent me a car, but I was like, I need a car. And so I borrowed $5,000 from my father to buy a car. And then so I was paying for school, paying my dad back. And I was like, cannot pay that car fast enough. And I like when I went to the DMV to get the plates, I put it in my name. I was like, this is my name. Even if something happens and I can't pay him back, he cannot take this car from me. Like this was like my saving. And then when I left, I was like, even if I have to sleep in my car, I am not going back. And that was, I was just like very, very committed. Like at least I have a car. And little Toyota Solera, her name was Sophia. She took me from the South to Mexico to St. Louis to Washington, D.C. to Los Angeles. I sold her in Los Angeles before I moved back to St. Louis and had almost 300,000 miles on her, 2010, like just, but she was my horse.
Yes,
my shining steed to get away.
Yes.
So having the car, having finances, and I realize that like I am giving abusers fodder to know like how to control people, because if my father had known that any of this would lead to me leaving, he would have sabotaged it. And so it was a very tentative. And I just like think about the dynamic between us those 2 years or whatever before I finally left. I was just like, so, you know, like everything is happy, like everything's fine. And he gave me roses on Valentine's Day and it made my skin crawl and I wanted to throw them away. But instead I went downstairs and was like, thank you for the flowers, daddy. And it was just like, you know, like all of these little games that we were both playing. Like it was like this fake, you know, interaction of like, everything is fine. And gratefully, he was living in denial and wanted to believe everything was fine. And I fed it, 100% fed that narrative. And then I left and basically had a mental breakdown because you're just like, wow,
don't know
so
why.
Tight. So tight.
Yes. And that's so like scary, really, for you to do that with. Because, I mean, it's very similar to how we grew up. And you really don't know anything on the outside. So yes. Even though, like, you're nannying and that's maybe your worldly experience is nannying or whatever other job. But even with that, because my dad allowed us to have jobs as teens, you know, older teens, I guess, once we could drive. And where most people, we were pretty rebellious for our group. So I had some outside influence with having a job in the world, but so the majority of you is still so tied to this group and the belief system that it almost doesn't matter. You know, like people are like, well, you went to public school though. And I did. And I'm super grateful for it, kind of. But it doesn't, we weren't allowed to do anything with anyone after school. Like, they were calm our school friends. That's truly what they were. Only at school, they were your friends. And so it's like, it seems like it would help, but I don't know that it does. I mean, I'm sure any amount of outside is good.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
But people often say that. Yes. And when we really truly left, luckily, I was married because we were married so young. So at least we had each other. But we had no clue what we were doing. Like, we did not know how to... We didn't know anything about life. Like, it is so sad how really not knowledgeable we were. And that we'd even, like, made it that far in life. but it is, like, I can't imagine you, like, you're an adult, and then you're all of a sudden alone and never have really made choices. But good for you that secretly you were making and choices, and they helped you.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that that's something I'm really passionate about now when I work with folks who have survived, is like excavating to find the resources that you had and that you did utilize, and like acknowledging where you did make choices and you did have agency and you did say no and you did take care of yourself in those spaces, because we leave those spaces and feeling so much shame, like, why did I let him do that to me? Why did I put up with this? Why did I pay rent when I wasn't allowed to do anything? You experienced so much shame. And so to acknowledge, like, how you did the best you could with the resources that you had at your disposal, and you were tapping into that, and you were listening to yourself, and you were, and that these choices that you made were for your survival. You did what you were supposed to do and what you had to do in that space, and kind of releasing that shame that we all experience when we leave these high control groups.
Before you left, when you were 26, were your siblings in the home still during that time?
Yeah, I had my brother, my oldest brother was in the army, and he might have been married. He might have been married by then. And I also think I had one sister who was also married. I'm kind of blanking on the timeline at the moment. I think that she was already out because she got married and my father had cut her off because she got married without his permission. And I think timeline, I think that she, that had already happened when I left. I'm not.
And so she married someone outside of the church?
No, he was still a good little Christian homeschool boy. So.
Wow. Yeah, but your father would have been
fine. It was all about control. Like, how dare she date someone without his permission and move out to marry this guy. And it was not about the character of the man. It was about my father's wanting control of that relationship. And the job was the same thing. It wasn't about, he didn't approve of the job that I had. It was about the fact that I took it without asking.
And are your parents still a part of this group, this
church? I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah,
you don't have contact with them, really.
I have no contact with my father. My mother's it's very casual. I don't know what they believe. I hear things. I couldn't tell you how they feel about me. I know enough to know that they haven't changed. And if they had it their way, like, they would still have those things. That some enough of it's still the same. I think that they had to recognize we have to let some things go or we're going to lose all of our kids. And so, but it's not any different. They haven't really changed, which is why I'm not in relationship with them. And so I don't know who their people are. I don't know what they believe right now. So
what about your siblings? Do you have relationships with them?
Yeah, it's different. It's different with all of them. Everyone's at different places. It's also based on gender, because even just the very simple thing, like if you're a boy, even though you're in the same abusive, controlling environment, if you're being raised to be your king of the household, and then the girls are being raised to always be subservient to a man and make a man's dreams come true, even if that is the only difference in the way that you're being raised, it will impact significantly how you show up in the world. And I have definitely noticed that difference between my brothers and my sisters and myself. And so, yeah, it's just kind of everyone's at different places. Everyone's at different places with education and how much education they got and how far away they moved from the South. Everyone's on a different journey at the moment.
I mean, if you don't mind sharing, you know, some professional advice for free, mm-hmm. like what are some, I won't say easy because recovery is not easy at all, but what are some kind of like key core things that you would say besides like reaching out for resources?
Yeah. And I think for everyone, you have so much of your agency taken away, and depending on if you joined it as an adult or you grew up in it, and there's a different experience if you joined as an adult, so you have a baseline and you remember what it was like to make decisions and to have an opinion and to have desires. And for whatever reason, for safety, for security, you ended up in this group. And for someone like me, I never had a voice. Like, I never really had agency. And so I had to start from scratch. But I think they're very similar. That process is very similar. Jarette told me that one of the things that she did when she left her group was when she would go to a restaurant. This is Drip Bouillon. She go to a restaurant. I think it was her who told me that she would order the very first thing on the menu that sounded good. And that was just kind of like her way of like, my desires matter, and like listening to my desire. And whatever it is, if it sounds good, the first thing that sounds good, that's what I'm ordering. And so just like little things. As I mentioned earlier, acknowledging how you were already somehow you left. So you had to have some kind of internal fortitude to know something was wrong and have just enough hope that things could be better in order to leave. Like, so something prompted that. And like, let's unpack that. Let's expand that. Let's let that grow. Like, you've never allowed space for that to grow, and now you have some opportunity, but not too fast, because it could be so overwhelming to have choices. and I think that some of the overwhelm that happens on the outside of a high control group will often prompt people to go to another high control group because they just want someone to tell them what to do and tell them what to believe. So I think getting comfortable with uncertainty, getting comfortable with ambiguity, sitting with those emotions, being comfortable saying, I don't know, like, I don't know where I am, you know, and even just especially the folks that I work with that are from evangelicalism, they're very, very heavy on you knowing what you believe. And so it can feel very disorienting to like suddenly not know. And like, getting comfortable just saying, I don't know. And I don't know how long I'm going to not know. And I'm just here. And I'm just present. And just presence, I think, is really important, because I think trauma, we're always, you know, living in the past, or we're just fearful and planning for the future. And so engaging in mindfulness and yoga and embodiment practices that allow us to just be present in our bodies and be in our space and just the here and now, and yeah, just being really focused on what we have right now and what we have control over right now. And yes, the future is terrifying, but we're not there yet. We're here.
And it's so, like, you saying that, I'm just like, it's so hard, like, because I am, and I'm sure it comes partially from how I was raised this way, but, like, I am such a controlling person. Mm-hmm. And that's one thing I've had to work on a lot in the past several years, because I have kiddos with behavioral issues. Mm-hmm. And so we have, you know, we've done the therapy and the classes and all the things. And so each of my kids, which, I mean, I think this is this way anyway, all kids are different in the, you know, you hear your parent, every child differently. It's so true. Uh-huh. But learning, like, I don't have control over these situations. Like, I truly don't have control. And it was such a, like, light bulb moment when I truly let that sink in. And how it changed the relationship, and I struggle with it to this day and always will, but how it changed the relationship with my children once I really truly got, like, you don't have control in this situation. Mm-hmm. So what do you have control of? How can you make some changes here? And it helped so much. But I think even the simple things, like you were saying, what Jarrett had said about picking out meals, that it seems so silly and simple, but that's huge. And I think even to this day, I just want someone to tell me what to do. I just want someone to say, this is how you do it. So do it, start there. And like, I want someone just to tell me how to do everything, because I think it's so ingrained to just follow. And you're not ever used to really having to think for yourself. And so it's like that part, and I'm sure part of it is just personality. It seems so silly, but it really is. It's a big deal. And I noticed how many places in my life that filters through. And it is. It's pretty scary. Or even like how you said, when you get out, you jump straight into something else. I know for us, hey, we didn't jump right back into it. But part of that for us was we were taught that all churches were very bad. So it wasn't, we were right, everyone else was wrong. Well, there's not, you know, we know all the people that believe like we did, or we thought we were it.
Yeah.
But like, there is this whole world of different organizations and churches, and not all are bad. I don't believe all are bad, but I do think that people that have backgrounds like us just do fall right into multi-level marketing. My dad was a multi-level marketing genius. Like, it was just one after the other. And then when I got out, actually, even before I got out, I started Pampered Chef.
I did Pampered Chef.
And then I did Cincy. I mean, I did a whole gamut of them. And now when you start learning all this stuff, I'm like, oh my gosh, it makes sense.
That was a cool too.
Yes. And that's, I swear, I mean, you know, that's why they, you know, it started with the women being able to work from home and all that. But I'm like, this is why they target church people, because they know that we value being at home with our kids. And they're like, boom, here we go. We're going to target these women, and how they've done real well with it.
And they did.
They obviously know what they're doing there. But yeah, but it's so easy.
Yeah, and I think when you grow up, and there's a high percentage of folks who end up in the church who had abusive upbringings. And I think when you grow up with the chaos of domestic abuse in your home, you migrate towards cults, towards high control religion, towards these things that provide security, because you've been so insecure and uncertain. And I did do that because I would say that even in my family of origin, even if it was so controlling, it was very chaotic and very confusing and double meanings in everything and, you know, constantly contradicting things, constantly contradicting whatever my father believed in the moment or wanted in the moment. And you just didn't know. It was so unpredictable. And so I went into a denomination that was very cerebral and very systematic because I was looking for that soothingness to my nervous system of this control. I don't think that was a bad desire to want some system and exist in my head when everything was so chaotic. I don't think that was a bad leaning. I think it was very human and very survival focused. And I think but they can also just make you susceptible to those high control groups because they know that we want that and they know that we're looking for that. And that is why we go from one place to another, because that nervous system never gets an opportunity to relax and to heal. So we're looking for the next thing that will keep us from having to be scared and will just help us, you know, tell us what to do, tell us what to believe. And it just takes that embodiment time of just letting our nervous systems heal and recognizing that we can give that security to ourselves, like constantly. Religion does this. Christianity does this. It kind of teaches you to look for that security outside of yourself by teaching you that you are sinful and bad. And so to kind of reverse that and like, actually, I'm good and I have all the resources that I need and I can reparent myself and I can give this assurance to myself and I can provide the security for myself. And getting to that place is not the day after you leave. Will not happen the day after you leave. It'll happen 20 years later, maybe. I'm still in that process.
You know, I've seen the little thing come up on Instagram, a little picture. It's super cute of someone saying of a little cartoon thingy with a bunch of flowers growing all over her. And then the other one's just kind of brown with like one little flower. and she's like, or the flowery one says, but we're supposed to grow, you know, like we are. We're supposed to be growing. Yes. And changing. Or I think she even said change. We're supposed to be changing. And it's true. It's like, if we stayed the same, like I hope that every day I am trying to be a better mom. And because guess what? Every day I fail. Every day I do something that I regret. And just learning how to kind of manage that. And then like you were even saying, like mindfulness and being mindful of, okay, I acknowledge that this happened. And then what can I do different next time said child does this, you know, just kind of to process it where it's still a challenge for me to do that. But I think it's the way to growth. You know, I have to acknowledge all the mistakes and not just mistakes, but just things that could use a little improvement or change wherever it might be. But it's hard. It's hard to, I really struggle with the mindfulness part because and I'm very like ADHD. So just to be present is super hard for me.
I don't know if we talked about this when we did your interview, how were like mistakes handled in your community? Like,
shameful.
You weren't allowed to make them.
We weren't allowed to make them, basically. Yeah. But if you did, like depending on the severity, and it really depended, I like to say, on what your last name was, because if you were valued, then your children might get to scrape things under the rug. But if you're not, like my family, then you're going to stand up front and repent. So it was like you would just have to stand up. They would tell the whole congregation what you did, and you have to say, I'm sorry. But it was always like a very public rebuke. Super fun. And if you screwed up before, like So there was probably, I'm guessing, like 100 people in our congregation locally. We called them assemblies. But then during holidays, because we couldn't celebrate any holidays, we would meet at the fairgrounds. And so like all of the assemblies from California would meet in Central California at the fairgrounds, and we would have a camp during Christmas, like coming up as a camp if anyone's interested. And which one of these days I want to go to one just to show up in like my little shorts. Like that's all I want to do. Just see if they kick me out or if they let me stay.
Jezebel.
Yeah, they hate me.
We're hoping that she converts soon. Hoping the Lord really brings her back to the flock.
Yes. So we would meet. So anyway, we'd meet at these fairgrounds for camp time, but there would be like 1,000 people because it's all of our assemblies all around California or Texas. Anyone could come. So if you screwed up around like camp time within, you know, a month, then it would get brought up at camp and you would have to stand up in front of all the people and all your friends from other assemblies. So you really wanted to screw up.
Did that ever happen to you?
No, not at a camp. I was a rule follower. I was terrified of getting caught. I mean, I did stuff, but I obviously was really good at hiding it because, I was a rule follower through and through. I mean, you would assume that. And so I was terrified of being caught. I never had to get up on stand. Like, no, I never had to. My husband did. But yeah. So it was, you know, it was always real. So yeah, it was very scary. Doing wrong was very scary. So you just didn't do it. You just didn't do it. And so, and you asked me that. And I think where you're going with that is like, now it's okay to be wrong. Like you were saying earlier, you know, it's like, to me, it's still very scary. I still get, even like with my husband, it's actually a big deal because we have to, you know, communicate. I get super defensive still because I don't want to be wrong. Like, I don't want to be wrong. And I know it, like, I know that I do that and I know it's not okay, like how I display it, but it is just like so built in. So that's why when I do like screw up, like whether it's I yell at the kids or I try always apologize because that is so important for me, for them to see that I am not perfect because I am not even close. We didn't have that. And so it was so scary to mess up. So my kids mess up all the time, so I'm assuming they're getting the message. they're like cool with it.
They
so
are
I
not
don't know.
On the rule follower track.
No, they are not. No, they are not.
A different degree.
They skipped that one, which I'm very thankful for. But sometimes I'm like, oh, but can we please brush your hair out?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think also in these communities, it's not just like everything was like on a right and wrong scale. And I think that that's something that I have had to learn is like there are a very, very few number of things that go on the right and wrong scale. Most things are on the personal preference scale. And I'm allowed to have a personal preference and other people are allowed to have a personal preference. And we can decide, like we can decide so many things. There's so many things that are just whatever we want to do, and so few things like murder. We probably collectively as a society think murder's bad. Most people think rape is bad, but questionable on that one depending on what community you're in. Embezzling money, stealing, you know, like there's just some things. It's like most people think this is wrong and this is going to be on the right or wrong scale. But most stuff isn't on that scale. Like most of the stuff just doesn't. And it's so freeing to me to not filter everything through. Is this right or wrong? And like, I need to pray over the dress that I wear to ask the Lord if it's okay to wear, or pray over the book that I choose to read, or just pretend like God's not watching, because I think if I did ask God, God would probably say no. So
right,
we're just sure
gonna, he said yes.
I'm just gonna say like God's not here right now.
Right.
Yeah, but I feel like that's very freeing. I have found that very freeing of just like, especially with other people. Like I don't have to have an opinion about your life. Like I don't need to, I don't need to care. Like I can care as much as you want me to care, but it's not my job to assess if you're living your life right. Like I can just kind of let you do what you want to do.
You can just move on. Right. And it is so freeing because it's so exhausting always, because we were all up in everyone's business. We knew everything about everyone in our group. And it is exhausting. Like, who should I be judging right now? Who needs extra prayer? Who needs like you're taking care of the whole world and it's
accountability.
A lot of pressure. Yes. Who needs accountability? Like a lot. And so it is quite a relief. And I actually feel very much the same way. I am like midline. Whenever people talk politics or anything, I'm just like, just remember, I'm right in the middle of that road with pretty much everything in life. Everything.
Yes.
And it is because I truly think like people need to have their own opinions. One thing that I'm big on is my kids. I want my kids to feel accepted no matter what they choose in life besides murder or the, you know, other bad things you mentioned. You know, I want them to know that they're accepted no matter what from me. And it's very important to me because we didn't feel that way growing up. It was like, well, I mean, you're good at this moment sitting on your metal chair looking forward and listening to leadership. But no, other than that.
Well, I mean, sure, that's very hard for you to manage, like knowing, like, as you said, that you don't have control over that. And like, it's either you get super, super controlled to manage that, or you like address your own nervous system, as you were saying, and just address what's coming up for you and be a healthy person for you so that you can interact in that healthy way that then will help them regulate. And it's a longer road. It's a much harder road. But I think long term, that's going to be so much more fruitful and productive for your relationship with your kids than if you were getting them to behave all the time and were being praised for being such a wonderful parent, but then your kids grow up and they hate you or they're robots. Yeah.
Right. Right. And mine aren't. So I keep telling myself, hey, I'm doing something right. They've got lots of free will. Doing something right. But it's, oh my gosh. It's a long
road, but it'll pay off.
Yeah.
It'll pay off.
So we laugh all the time about, I'm like, I talk with my sister. I'm like, there is no possible way any child in our family would have survived growing up the way we grew up. Like, I can't even, or the parents, I can't even imagine having my kids, and they're all older now too. Even at the ages they are now, there is no way they could sit for 2 hours plus and some on a metal chair listening to a sermon.
Yep.
There's no way. And that's what all kids, everyone, we all met together and there was no Sunday school or anything. So it was like, you had to. You sat there for hours.
You won't be joining no cults right now.
No. I'm like, you guys do not have what it takes to be in a cult. So, so far, that's good
cult
news.
School.
Yes,
no cult for you.
I was an A-plus student in cult school for sure. Just follow the leader.
I know. And I just think of like how many ways that the community that I was in like forced me to be dishonest and lie.
Yes.
And how I used to like feel a lot of like shame for that because lying is bad and you shouldn't lie. And yet to look at those situations and being like, actually, like it was comply or lie. And most of the time I lied. And I think that was appropriate for the community that I was in. I don't think hiding that I was doing college or, you know, removing my parents from my bank account, secret spy shit. For a purpose. It was for survival. You know, telling selective truths to certain people and to my parents and you're raised to be like so honest and like lying is like the worst possible sin and to like have to like quote unquote sin in order to survive and like realize like now just like having a lot of compassion for myself and also cheering myself on that I would risk my soul to survive this community and now I'm like, you're a little badass, like That was
super was proud of yourself now.
Good way to say you pulled the wool over their eyes, use some of their tactics against you. And and like you did what you had to do. You were scrappy and you figured it out and you got out and those you have to do those things for survival and then finding spaces where you're no longer in survival. So this isn't necessary anymore. This doesn't serve anymore. I don't need to do this because I am actually safe now. And this isn't, I don't need this survival mechanism anymore. And let those things go. So it's not right or wrong. It's survival or not survival.
Yeah. Well, and I think so much of that, the lying part of it, because we were always, you know, told that the world and everyone was hypocrites. And it's so funny now because it's like, that's what we were. But because they taught us to be. They taught us to, like, you better lie and be a really good hypocrite because if it's found out, you know.
Face.
Yes. Fake it till you make it. But it created really good, dishonest people. Really good. Lying is so natural and it's just your first reaction, even for stupid stuff. Like, did you eat both pieces of bread? No. Like, it could be so stupid, but it's, and that's something I feel like I've not mastered. Never have I mastered anything, but like, I've done really well with it. I feel like that was one of the things earlier on I got a hand on because I noticed it. Like, why does it matter if I had two pieces of bread? Like, why am I feeling I need to lie about that? Even the question wasn't even like a you're in trouble. Right. And so I think it's that instinct of, like you said, like, oh, I'm in trouble. I need to lie. Oh, I'm in trouble. I need to lie. Where it's like, no, you're not anymore. You've got, you know, it's that survival mechanism and you want to just, And like you said, it served its purpose, you know, like when I needed my lying mechanism, it worked and it helped me survive. But now I don't need it, you know, and it's hard. And I think that's probably a lot of what you do, but it's that deconstruction part of this all, you know. Awesome.
And we're allowed to take a break from it all.
Yes, we are.
We spend a lot of time healing. Sometimes you just need to watch a funny movie.
Yes, I did that this week. Yes. Oh my gosh. Yes. And take
what funny movie did you watch?
Six Nights, 7 Days.
Okay, is it like a rom com?
Okay. Yeah. But this is trauma. But I like to watch things that I've already seen a lot of times, so I know what to expect.
You know what happened?
Yes. So
I had never thought of that as like a trauma thing. Because I know some people who just like rewatch, and I'm like, I would be so bored if I like knew what was going to happen. As that being like a trauma thing of like, I know what to expect. I know how this is going to end.
I mean,
I totally get that.
It is. Yeah.
I totally get that.
So and then I'm very ADHD too. So a lot, I'll have a movie going, but I can't just sit and watch a movie. So I'm usually working on my computer or reading or something. I'm really special. I was very proud of myself. I took a break from cult, you know, docs and
cult documentaries. I'm really into murder documentaries right now.
Yes.
Murder and crime documentaries.
Yay. Oh my gosh. Okay. Well, thank you, Catherine, so much for being here.
So fun.
So fun. And I feel like I'm going to need to just like book a session with you so we can just dig into all of these things.
Anytime,
we'll just hang out. I love it.
Yes. Well, thank you so much. Yay! Pretty fun.
Thank you all for joining me for another episode of the Shanty Pants Show. I really appreciate you guys hanging out with me every week. You can find all of my links to all my social medias, anything your heart desires, at shantypantsshow.com. You can even find my amazing merch is back up and running there. And you can email me from there, all the things. Also, you always ask, how can you help me out with this whole podcast situation? You can subscribe to my podcast, you can leave reviews, you can share it with friends. I appreciate it all. So I am super excited to bring you guys the rest of the season. It's going to be amazing. And I'll see you next week.
Thank you.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.